This is Rebecca Daniel Burke, your host for the American Counseling Association's 2008 podcast series. Today we're speaking with counselors, authors, and presenters Bob Walsh and Norm Dazenbrook. Norm Dazenbrook is a licensed clinical professional counselor with over 27 years of experience in the mental health field. Norm practices in Rockford, Illinois. Bob Walsh is a licensed clinical professional counselor with over 33 years of experience as a helping professional. Bob also practices in Illinois in Western Springs. But what makes Bob and Norm consummately qualified to be speakers today on private practice is that they both have a very successful private practice. Together, Bob and Norm present their well-attended workshop, How to Start, Maintain, and Expand a Successful Private Practice. Welcome, Bob and Norm.
Thanks. Hi, Rebecca.
It's nice to have you here today. I want to start by saying that I read your book, The Complete Guide to Private Practice for Licensed Mental Health Professionals, and this was the fourth edition. And I found it an excellent resource for any counselor out there who is interested in beginning, growing, or enhancing their private practice. The first question that comes to mind as I think about that is this, is what is the viability of starting a private practice at this time, and what's actually necessary for me to start one now?
I think right now, as we talk about in our workshops, right now is an excellent time to start a practice. I think the stigma for counseling has been dramatically reduced over the years that I've been in practice. People are much more willing to go see a counselor now. And it's not necessarily always treating mental illness. There's quality of life issues, family issues, issues with children and adolescents. And so right now, I think, is an extremely good time for a counselor who is considering private practice to decide to realize their dream and to give it a shot.
You know, whenever you see the advice columns in newspapers, mm-hmm. It uses the word counseling mm-hmm. and see a counselor. And, you know, that really is gratifying to me because it's actually identifying our title as a, sort of a generic term.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't it feel sometimes with the term counselor that it feels less daunting that I'm going to a therapist or I'm going to a psychologist? Does that seem true to you?
Well, I think in the past that mm-hmm. People thought that it was a you know kind of an overwhelming issue, but you know I mean I just you know sometimes see on TV and some of the regular programming that you know. People would go to a counselor on the TV show, and mm-hmm. you know, I think that both men and women now don't see it as stigma mm-hmm. as it was in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And I think too that you know people take a look at it could be you know a phase of life issue. It could be you know you don't have to be in counseling for years.
Right.
I think the average number of sessions per counseling episode nationally is 6 to 8.
Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah, so people come in, there's an adjustment they need to make, something they want to bounce something off of,
mm-hmm.
they want to get an objective opinion, or just to be able to go into somebody's office that's non-judgmental and be able to talk about whatever they want to and be able to get some help with that.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Now, what would I, as a private, if I were going to go into private practice, what kind of expenses would I have to incur in the beginning?
Well, what we do in our workshops is we present two roads to follow.
Mm-hmm.
Norm presents a full setup, key in the door office, and I talk about what is I label it as the shoestring approach, where you can start out with very little money. And it seems to be a good approach. People like that approach because they can see, you know, both if you have some money to invest, then you can go the way that Norm presents. And then if you are going to start out with a limited practice, we don't call it part-time private practice, but a limited practice, then you can keep your day job and be able to do it the way that I present.
Why don't you call it part-time?
We don't call it part-time because if you go to a physician or mm-hmm. if you go to let's say a dentist, you know, you wouldn't feel very good about going to a part-time dentist. to be maybe flip about it, if you were going to go see the brain surgeon, you know, you wouldn't want to have a part-time brain surgeon. So I don't think we should be considered part-time counselors or therapists.
What an excellent point. I never even thought about that in all these years. That's wonderful. What do I need to consider in terms of timing? What's the right time?
You know, it's almost like having children. You know, if you wait till the right time, you never do it.
Right.
You know, it's the old Nike ad that says, just do it. You know, mm-hmm. We talk to so many people that said, well, you know, I think I might do it this year or maybe next. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the mantra is just do it. And mm-hmm. I think before even renting office space or deciding on, you know, a budget, it's trying to do the work in your own head to be able to get that business hat on.
Mm.
You know, we're very well-trained clinicians with excellent skill set, but we don't have the business piece. And I guess that's the biggest thing that Bob and I see when people have difficulty is they don't have that mindset.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they need to see themselves as, you know, a chief executive officer, a CEO of a for-profit corporation. They need to be able to see themselves as an entrepreneur. Someone that's willing to take and maintain a risk.
Well, it's funny because what we talk about is that, you know, we help our clients to take risks. We tell them to go ahead and try things. And yet if we're afraid to try things, we're not very good models. You know, we call it the entrepreneur hat. And, you know, we kind of say, you know, you can cock that hat a little bit and kind of jut your jaw out and you know, get started.
Yeah, it's very difficult sometimes for people to hold the tension of the opposites. And in this point, in this this incidence, it's the tension of I'm a clinician, and it's also okay to be an entrepreneur when I'm a clinician.
Yeah, business and counseling can go together in the same sentence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you had a product or a widget that you were selling that helped teenagers communicate better with parents, that could diagnose depression, that could help somebody consider another option besides suicide, diagnose ADD, that would be a very valuable product.
And
that is the counselor.
Mm-hmm.
And the counselor needs to be able to see themselves as that valuable product and be able to market themselves and set up an office and be able to maintain that if people are going to benefit from their services.
And that is one of the interesting points about all of this is thinking about commitment. Like, what kind of a commitment would I have to be willing to make if I start, say, having seeing a few clients each evening after I work, or seeing clients on Saturday, and I'm just kind of starting to move into private practice? What kind of commitment would I need to make?
Well, one of the things I do with the shoestring approach is that people start, you know, 2-3 months in advance and, of course, get a telephone. Telephone can be either a landline or a cell phone. Cell phones can work for somebody that's just starting out. There's a lot of options and, you know, flexibility with a cell phone. And then the second thing, of course, is to obtain office space. And what we do is we give them four different options. One of them is to sublet from an established professional that's already in the area that they'd like to have their practice. The second one is kind of creative. It's what I did. I contacted an MD who was practicing and made an agreement with that doctor that I would use office space whenever there was no one there. The good thing about that was I got somebody who was in the same niche. It was a pediatrician, and I was able to I saw children and teenagers, and so I really helped him, and he really helped me out and, you know, let me put my name on the door. You know, a lot of the counselors see us at our workshop during the break and say, come on, Bob, you got to be kidding me. You know, a doctor's way up there on the hill, and we're just counselors. And I say, you know, you can't approach it that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the worst thing can happen is they'd say no.
Mm-hmm.
And a doctor typically sees people from 7 to 10 minutes in their office, and somebody has a crisis or there's some issues that they want to discuss with a counselor, it would be very much good for their practice if they had a brochure and they say, well, you can see us here. The thing that the kids liked was that they could see their pediatrician in the office and then see the counselor in the office at the same time later that evening.
Mm-hmm.
And renting your own space, of course. Mm-hmm. You know, Norm talks more about that. And, you know, there's home offices where, mm-hmm. you know, there are tax write-offs and other benefits for that. Mm-hmm. And visiting the itinerant counselor is another approach.
I really like the idea of going to a doctor's office. I really never thought about this until I read your book. But I actually have a friend in San Francisco who has done that. And she has developed a bit of a specialty in postpartum depression. And she took up office space with a group, an OBGYN group, and how wonderful for all of them, for the OBGYN doctors and for her. What are some other good pairings that you can think of?
Well, you know, that's a really good one, and mm-hmm. the nutrition one. The general practitioner is good. One of the GPs that I worked with wanted to have a parenting group in the waiting room. And so, you know, they were able to promote a parenting group, which was a really good service to the clients. They call them patients. We just moved the chairs around in the waiting room, and it was a really good marketing tool as well, because those people all during break would be really kind of coming up to us and asking, hey, listen, you know, we'd like to see you individually. Is mm-hmm. it possible? And, of course, we had our appointment book right there ready.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
We're very happy to set them up individual appointments.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and in terms of pairings, too, I think one of the trends in the future is going to be chronic diseases. Mm. And you see that now with cardiology.
Mm-hmm.
Counseling is being used more often, diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
Any chronic disease counseling, pain management counseling is being used more and more, and I really see that, you know, there are going to be mm-hmm. more perhaps one-stop shopping
mm-hmm.
Where there'll be a number of providers in an office that not only treat, you know, the psychological aspects, the medical
mm-hmm.
aspects, spiritual aspects, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So that might be something that people want to take into account as they project themselves going into private practice. But as Bob said, you can start from subletting office space from somebody for a couple hundred mm-hmm. dollars a month to renting your own space for a couple of thousand.
Mm-hmm.
I think the biggest regret that I have in private practice is I should have bought the building.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't do it.
mm-hmm.
And I can't tell you how many hundreds of thousands of dollars I've spent in rent.
Yeah, and back when you could have gotten
yes,
it for less.
Exactly.
Yeah, I definitely understand that. You know, you brought up an interesting point, and you said chronic pain. I was reading an article the other day about the baby boomer generation and things we need to do to prepare for the baby boomer generation becoming a population of aging citizens. And one of the things they talked about was chronic pain. So
mm-hmm.
that's interesting that you brought that up. I think that might be a very timely thing for some of our listeners to think about. Okay, now I have an office, and how do I go about advertising or marketing my practice?
Well, Bob has a wonderful eight-step method that I'm sure he'll share the highlights
mm-hmm.
about. Today, we try to take a look at a two-prong approach.
Mm-hmm.
How do you market directly to the potential client that you want to treat, and how do you market directly to those professionals, agencies, organizations that come in contact with the type of client that you would like to treat.
Mm-hmm.
And so you need to take a look at a two-prong marketing approach. And we also talk about numerous campaigns, numerous advertising, marketing. People need to see things two or three times.
Mm-hmm.
I think all too often we try one marketing campaign or one advertising campaign, and then we sit back and wait. But it needs to be smaller and more repetitions
mm-hmm.
to it to make it more effective.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the third step in my eight-step method after getting a phone and getting office space is
mm-hmm.
to be a speaker. And being a speaker, either ordering seminar or group materials, and you can acquire those through various places.
Mm-hmm.
Our book mentions a couple of really good sources. Impact Publishers
mm-hmm.
Is a really good one, and people can just Google that. But
mm-hmm.
We use the STEP program, Systematic Training for Effective Parenting, Time,
mm-hmm.
Training in Marriage Enrichment,
mm-hmm.
and maybe something that people develop themselves. We did a really popular one on homework help husband and wife communication skills.
Mm-hmm.
And those we do for very little just enough to cover our expenses. But if we do a 3-hour or 2-hour presentation, pro bono without any kind of pay.
Mm-hmm.
What's good about that is that a lot of the churches and synagogues and community centers are willing to advertise that free of charge because it's a free service to the community. And those speaking engagements really do generate an awful lot of interest. And we've actually had newspaper feature articles about husband and wife communication and, you know, took pictures and
mm-hmm.
all of that for free. And you know, that's a really great way to start out. You know, being able to speak is a really important talent, I guess,
mm-hmm.
that I wouldn't say talent, but ability to speak is really an important mm-hmm. thing to
A skill. Isn't it true, and we're going to get back to letting you finish, but I just want to interject something. I think it's actually worth it for people to go and pay somebody to teach them how to become a good speaker.
Yes, we talk about going to some of the speaking groups. I can't think of the names right now.
I think it's Toastmasters.
Oh, Toastmasters, yes.
And then there's Toastmistresses.
Oh, right.
Yes.
We need both.
Or you can hire a coach because
mm-hmm.
You can't overstate it enough. Public speaking mm-hmm. is probably one of the premier ways to either start a practice or
mm-hmm.
be able to grow a practice.
Mm-hmm.
In our area of helping, people like to make some kind of connection.
Mm-hmm.
And if they can see you speak or somebody that talk to a friend that's heard you or seen you, that really helps make that personal connection.
You know, when I was in the San Francisco Bay Area, I was actually sent with a whole group of people from the healthcare system that I worked for, sent to a coach who
mm-hmm.
basically took pictures, he took videos of us while we were speaking. We all sat around and critiqued the videos. After a week with this coach, you were actually a good public speaker, even if you were a bad one when you went in, and that was shocking to me. I think it was the best money that healthcare system paid was to have their directors go and get this kind of help.
Well, in our presentations, we cite the fact that, you know, neither one of us were very good at presenting,
mm-hmm.
But that when we say, you know, presentations and speaking is an important talent that you need to do,
mm-hmm.
you know, we see these kind of looks at us like, oh, my gosh, we can't do that. But we tell them, you know, the idea is that if you love the topic and
mm-hmm.
you really prepare yourself, but if you want to really share something you feel very strongly about,
mm-hmm.
Then your presentation will be a good presentation.
That's a wonderful point. And Bob, I wanted to get back to you so you could finish your 8 points.
Sure. After you do a 2 or 3 hour presentation on a topic, then what you do is promote a 6 week, 4 to 6 week seminar.
Mm-hmm.
And in these seminars, it's either the STEP program or communication between husband and wife or partners. And during those, make sure that there's break time with cookies or water or
mm-hmm.
you know, coffee where people can kind of mill around and come up to you and ask questions.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very good marketing time.
Mm-hmm.
A good brochure to hand out and nearby having the appointment book to be able to write and jot down names in there for appointments is pretty significant. At this point, then I do charge, and
mm-hmm.
I do charge based on covering, you know, my hourly expenses. At that time, you know, the practice begins. Now, you know, with that,
mm-hmm.
usually people would fill maybe 3-4 appointments a week. But if you think about it, 3-4 appointments a week can be a car payment, you know, and
absolutely.
You know, it certainly enhances somebody's income.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. After that, then the next is to build a practice. The seventh step is to start talking to yourself about payment structure,
mm-hmm.
how to do managed care,
mm-hmm.
office upgrades. You know, I've got some artwork in my office now that I'm able to afford. I've
mm-hmm.
Been in it for a while, and other practice expanding issues.
Mm-hmm.
And the eighth step is to consider yourself at a plateau. You
mm-hmm.
go back to step three and start all over again. I don't do
mm-hmm.
any seminars now because I'm really full.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not able to, my practice is closed. But
mm-hmm.
If I found myself with a dip in
mm-hmm.
in appointment times, I would go back to step three and start all over again.
Yeah, one thing I'd like to ask you both at this point, and we're going to talk about managed care and insurance after this, but one of the things I loved when I was reading your book was that for both of you, it was not an easy, trouble-free path to private practice. And I would like you each to just say a little about that, because I really think both of your stories are fascinating.
Well, I think the important part about that is being able to risk the failure.
Yes.
You know, and as I look back over my career and Bob as well, we tried a number of things that didn't pay off. But as we tell our clients, and I think what both of us have experienced, when one door closes, another door opens up, if you're looking for it. You know, we started a long time ago trying to do smoking cessation groups when Nicorette gum first came out. And back then I was still smoking. I was doing it with a physician who had the research rights, and we lost thousands of dollars on promotions and groups, and I finally since have quit. But you know,
good for you, by the way. That's not an easy thing to quit.
right.
For you,
yeah. You know, we did that. I started in the 70s in Rockford, Illinois, a sex therapy practice with a psychiatrist, gynecologist, urologist. We had newspaper articles, and, you know, what were we thinking? It was 1983, and Rockford had the highest unemployment of any city in the nation. And 6 months later, we closed the door. But by doing that, I had formed these relationships with these physicians that continue to refer to me today.
And by doing that, you came to where you are today.
Yes.
So I love that. You know, I mean, it's so hard for all of us when we fall down on that path, you know. But both of you, you know, it was a bumpy road. It wasn't a smooth road. And how about you, Bob?
Well, the biggest impediment for me was to go back a bit, I started out with pediatricians. I was in their office. It was in the late 70s, early 80s, and at that time, docs felt no compunction about signing off on insurance forms, and so I was covered by insurance, but master's-level counselors at that time weren't covered by any managed care or insurance company. And then managed care hit, and there was a social worker, another counselor, and myself in the office, and we were almost bumping into one another. We were, you know, really very successful, and bam, after managed care, both of the other people had to leave the office. We didn't have enough referrals because people wanted to use their insurance. So what we did is I, along with our state organization, did some research. You know, somebody told me, I think a psychiatrist said, you know, you're not going to be able to practice, you know, and just don't tell me no. Because what we did is we petitioned all of the managed care companies in the area, in the state, and nationally, and the first one to come through was Blue Cross Blue Shield of Illinois. And it was just a real gratifying thing. I got a call at about 6 o'clock in the morning saying, yeah, I think we're going to cover counselors. You know, don't worry. You know, we'll get back to you and give you the details. Well, the other big ones, Magellan and Aetna and the others all came into line. And today, in most states, managed care and insurance covers counselors.
I know. Isn't that amazing?
Yes.
I'm just delighted. And there's more mental health parity kind of acts that probably will go through, and it'll get even better.
I think that the important thing for counselors to remember is that, you know, looking at this, it seems like a daunting task, getting involved in managed care and insurance. But, you know, we did it when it was really daunting, when nobody was accepting us. And what we use is the same approach, getting individual counselors on panels. Even panels that are closed. So the working with managed care and insurance scares people, but I think that we have to approach it because if you're really going to serve members, people, people in your community, then you really have to consider insurance, unless you're in a very wealthy area. But I think that it's very important. Managed care and insurance can be your friend.
Well, you know, that was the next thing I was going to ask you about, is just to step back and for a minute say, should I deal with managed care and insurance at all? I mean, is there an alternative? I personally know of one person who actually doesn't deal with managed care, gives a bill, a copy of the bill, to the client, and they can decide to deal with their managed care or not with it. And he's successful. But most of the people I know who've tried that, it just didn't work out. They really needed to partner with managed care and insurance. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, really, to me, decide, you know, what is your vision?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if your vision is a limited practice, seeing, you know, 5 to 7 clients per week,
mm-hmm.
Maybe you don't need to take a look at insurance or managed health care. Mm-hmm. But if you're looking at a thriving practice, 25 client hours per week, maybe 30, we would strongly encourage people to take a look at insurance and managed health care. And the landscape for this is so much better today. I mean, everybody's got the horror stories out there. You see all sorts of people advertising, you know, how to do a managed health care free practice. And in my community, it's blue collar, and people need to use their insurance, and more so even today with the economy and price of gas. People want to be able to access their benefits.
Yes, absolutely.
And so, you know, to be able to market yourself effectively, you need to be on some of these insurance company lists and managed healthcare panels to be able to promote yourself. And it's so much easier today than it was before. You don't have all the extensive paperwork that we used to have. Utilization review is much better, and Bob can probably speak more to that than I. But we found it a way to work with managed health care that can augment a practice and not detract from it.
Well, Rebecca, if I didn't take managed care or insurance, my major referral sources are doctors. I wouldn't get any of those.
Yeah.
Because it's a medical model, and they all take insurance, and they want to be able to refer their patients. If I didn't take insurance, you know, they wouldn't even consider me.
That's a really good point. And another question that comes up is, let's say I do have this new practice. I've started the private practice. I've got Bob and Norm's book on my desk, and I'm trying to figure out how to do this. What do I need for billing clients?
Well, there's several billing software programs. That's one of the ways that people can start off. It's not too expensive. And, you know, we can we have got the names of several that we think are pretty good. And people can Google them, and they can even try them out for free online just to see how they work. And what happens is that the insurance claim form is printed out. The cost of those programs are generally from $5 to maybe $1,000, depending on whether they want to have Internet email kind of billing and electronic billing. And the next step after that, the other the next one would be the idea of having someone billing.
You work for, you have a billing company that you hire to do your billing for you. Is that
right.
What you mean?
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
Okay, the first one that I have is that electronic claims submission is an efficient way, and I think that insurance companies are going to be requiring them of them.
And people seem to really like them. Do you find that?
Well, I've used one, and you know, the trouble is I'm kind of a control guy, and I want to have all of my data on my computer and be able to access it so that I can bill for, you know, co-payments and so forth. You know, people really are beginning to start that, and I think one of the things that one of us or both of us are going to do is really get into that, because we're presenting to people who are trying to start private practice, and we need to be able to give examples. Another one is to use online billing. There are websites for entering claims online, and what happens is there's a monthly agreement, and we enter our patient information into there, and what happens is then it goes directly for a monthly or annual fee directly to the insurance or managed care company. And, you know, those are Navinet Claims and ENS Health Care Paths. Those are all companies that do that for a fee. Another way is to outsource your medical billing to a service company, and for a percentage, what they'll do is they will submit it. And the nice thing about them is the ones that we know about do all the pre-utilization review. They get approval. They make sure that any denials get addressed. And the nice thing about that is that the one we know about, it's a $6 per client per submission. They take care of all the stuff that, you know, all of us hate to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, it, it's, it seems to me to be fairly fairly inexpensive way to go.
Well, that way you don't have the upfront costs. If you're starting out and don't have a lot of money to invest, you know, you're kind of paying as you're going. Mm-hmm. And then maybe once you get up and running with that, then you can consider buying your own software or just go ahead and do that right away.
Mm-hmm.
Because to me, I agree with Bob, I like to have the information at my fingertips.
Sure, sure.
The way that I think I'm going to go, the mm-hmm. way that I think I will go is to contract with each of the managed care companies or insurance companies, and especially the big ones. I have an awful lot of mm-hmm. of work with one particular managed care company, and what I'll do is I'll directly bill their
mm-hmm.
website.
Mm-hmm.
And they make it fairly simple to do.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they want to do that because it helps them. They don't have to hire people to do paper
mm-hmm.
management. And the other benefit to that is it's, you know, still in my computer.
Mm-hmm.
I have all access to that information. I still have to make sure I do, you know, any utilization review or any follow-up. But
mm-hmm.
the great thing about that is that the money then is deposited directly into my my bank account.
Right. Ooh.
And
uh-huh.
that's usually within 2 days. So,
uh-huh.
you know, that's the one that seems to be the best to me.
You know, I wanted to just step back for one moment, and because we're talking about managed care now, and one of the questions that I get, and I'm sure you both get, is how do I get impaneled? And so that's part of the question. The second part is, what do you think about using the Council for Affordable Quality Health Care, CAQH, when you want to start getting impaneled?
Well, we're both in CAQH,
okay.
and we advocate its use. I think it's mm-hmm. somewhat plateaued right now. When it first came out a few years ago, a lot of insurance companies were signing up with it.
Mm-hmm.
And
can you say for a minute what it is in case any of our listeners are not clear about it?
It's a very interesting concept.
Mm-hmm.
CAQH was the insurance companies coming together where providers would submit electronically their provider data just once.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than filling out an application with all your identifying data
mm-hmm.
For every insurance or managed health care company, you did it once.
Mm-hmm.
And then the insurance companies and managed health care could go ahead and access it from one site, which would
mm-hmm.
be CAQH.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea makes a whole lot of sense, and is at no cost to counselors
mm-hmm.
to be able to sign up. And as they look for providers in your area, they can just get your information from CAQH.
Mm-hmm.
In order to be in CAQH, you need to be invited.
Mm.
Means you need to be referred from an insurance or managed health care company.
Mm-hmm.
One of the ways we found to be effective, and actually Bob figured this one out, if you apply for Aetna,
mm-hmm.
They will automatically refer you to CAQH.
Mm. Oh,
and then that opens up 400 or 500 different insurance and managed health care companies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One of the many things I like about your book is in the back all the listing and all the contact information for the different managed care companies, and also in some cases you provide what fees they pay. And that brings me to another question. How do you decide, I mean, in some cases with managed care you don't have a choice, but how do you decide where to set your fee?
Bob, do you want to speak to the managed health care since you're the resident expert?
Well, You know, what I think we need to do is to set the fee with the community standard. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, a very simple way, people think this is going to be a really hard thing to do, but
mm-hmm.
what you do is you call 3 or 4 counselors or
mm-hmm.
psychologists in your area and find out what, you know, basically they're charging.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't go to the top and I wouldn't go to the bottom, but I would go
mm-hmm.
somewhere in between,
mm-hmm.
set my fee there. My fee is, you know, somewhere in the middle of my area.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when you work with a managed care company, what they do is they give a percentage of your usual and customary, or
mm-hmm.
some of the managed care companies have a fixed fee that they pay everyone.
They might say, we will pay you $65 or $70 for an individual hour. Is that correct? That's how it might go.
That's about how it goes, and
mm-hmm.
then, you know, you can collect your copay from the client.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I, for my usual and customary, I don't get, I charge $115. I don't generally
mm-hmm.
get that.
Mm-hmm.
But what I do is I collect what I get from the insurance company based on the fact that I contract with them and they send me clients.
Sure, absolutely.
You know, the analogy I always use is that, you know, you look at any airline,
mm-hmm.
and you interview all the people who are on that plane. A businessman may be paying, a business person may be paying, you know, $350 to fly to New York, and there may be some families that have gone on Travelocity or one of the other discount fare, and they get referrals from that, and they're able to pay much less. So, you know, it people sometimes rankle at that, the idea that they wouldn't be able to get their full fee, but, you know, it's part of doing business.
Yeah, I agree. And any thoughts from you, Norm, on fee setting?
I agree with Bob. The whole idea is to take a look at community standard. And, again, what we do about once a year is we call four or five other counseling practices and get an idea of what fees they charge to get an idea of how we want to set ours. And Bob, I think, raises a good point. You don't lowball. You don't say, well, if everybody's charging around 120 to 150, I'm going to go at 100. People aren't going to choose a counselor based on a fee. They're going to choose a counselor based on reputation and expertise and referral by word of mouth. And so trying to be the Walmart or the Kmart of counseling isn't going to pay off.
Interesting. Now, in terms of the future, so I have my private practice now that I have set up using your book as a guideline, and what kind of things do you think we're going to see in the future in terms of specialty, in terms of needs? Do you have any thoughts on that, either of you?
Well, I think you brought it up earlier, Rebecca, in the interview, as we take a look at the aging of the population.
Yes.
That is going to be an area that I think is just going to continue to prosper. I think chronic diseases, illnesses will be a good niche to be taking a look at. And you can't discount what we have right now. There's always going to be adolescents.
Absolutely.
Right? There's always going to be relationship difficulties, depression, anxiety. You know, while the treatments today are much more effective, what we find is people are going more and more for some of the same kinds of conditions that I think will always be there.
Norm, maybe you should talk about your mediation for marriage.
And sometimes we need to think a little bit outside the box. While we talk about traditional talk therapy, we take a look at multiple income streams. What else can I do in my practice to sustain me outside of just traditional talk therapy? Mediation, divorce mediation, I'm a court-appointed mediator, and we work with the local courts here as an alternative to litigation. What we see also looming in the future is what's called collaborative law, where counselors, social workers, and psychologists are a part of the process to help a family transform to mom and dad living in two different houses raising children. And it's not, you know, 80% of a divorce is emotional, 20% of it's legal. And counselors now have can have a role with some specific training. I'm a collaborative law professional and work with the attorneys to help deal with the emotional component to the divorce. So, you know, things that we're doing right now weren't available 10 years ago. So I guess part of it is that entrepreneurial spirit of being open to new things and new directions that don't even present themselves today.
You know, I think another way to partner with somebody in the legal field is the whole piece around retirement now, given the baby boomer generation. So what, you know, one thing is, when do I retire? You know, how do I decide what I'm going to do to feel fulfilled in the way I usually feel fulfilled when I go to work? And, you know, a lot of emotional things about retirement and estates and all of that.
And I would agree. I think the other piece of it that we see, too, is you see a whole lot of people that have moved up the ladder, and they're not happy there. So now they're the managers, they're directors, they're the VPs, and they say, you know, I've worked all this time and I'm not happy. I might want to take a step down. I might want to raise orchids. I might want to do something different because, you know, I've worked for such a long period of time to get to where I'm at, and it's not fulfilling.
Exactly. Or when you get to that retirement place, you know, so you can't work 80 hours a week in a high-pressure corporate environment anymore. Well, what are you going to do that's meaningful for you with the rest of your life? So I think that there's a lot around that piece, that demographic piece of the baby boomers. You know, our time is about coming to an end, and it has been very fascinating listening to both of you. I would like to ask you one more question, and we'll kind of wind things up. And I'm always interested if you have, it's either of you or both of you have, some kind of theoretical hero in the field of counseling. Was there somebody who really spoke to you when you were becoming a counselor and moving into private practice? Is there some theorist or some practitioner that that was really a hero for you?
Well, I studied under John Carlson, who has been identified by ACA as one of the superheroes of, I hope he doesn't mind me saying that, of our profession. And he was my advisor in graduate school. I went to graduate school because I wanted to be able to be a better teacher, and he had the Adlerian background. And
He's an Adlerian,
that's right.
Uh-huh.
And so it helped me in the classroom, but I worked my way out of the classroom, and John is just an incredible encourager. And just a great model, and so I would certainly cite John Carlson as mine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and a little bit more closer to home, I guess, for me. I worked at a community mental health center. I went there actually to do my internship for my master's degree, and owing the state of Illinois thousands of dollars, they offered me a job, and I took one. Part of my training there was with our staff psychiatrist. I've got all my textbook learning, and he was one that really helped me translate that to treating clients and families, and was very inspirational. And it was very encouraging about starting a private practice back then, because the only people that were in private practice were psychologists, a couple of social workers, and psychiatrists. And he really encouraged those of us that were counselors to consider that as a viable option. And the last person that I would like to credit was my father, who finally said, "When are you going to do it? You've been talking about it for 2 years. When are you going to do it?"
Good for him.
He was
the original Nike guy.
I should have trademarked it at that point.
Absolutely. That's wonderful. Okay, well, thank you so much, Bob Walsh and Norm Dazenbrook, for joining me today to discuss your excellent book, The Complete Guide to Private Practice, and for your very interesting discussion on all things private practice.
Well, thank you, Rebecca. It's a pleasure for me.
Thank you. Thank you. Please go to the American Counseling Association's website at www.counseling.org and click on the podcast page for all the associated links, or to write to the authors and to the host. This is Rebecca Daniel Burke, your host of the ACA 2008 podcast series, signing off.